Thank you all for coming this morning. We're going to get started, and before we get started, I'd like to let you know in the folders we provided, in addition to some other materials, there's a fact sheet on Iraq's parliamentary elections, which I think you'll find helpful. I'd also like to say to our colleagues who stayed in bed this morning, who are going to listen to this on audio later and on transcript, would welcome them after the fact. But today, those of you who are here, we have a real treat. We have two people who are really thinking outside the box when it comes to Iraq and elections and some of the other things that are going on there. And I'll just throw it to Rick Barton.
Thanks, Andrew. It's a pleasure to be here with all of you this morning and also with John Alderman. I'm going to just give a brief description of the election, some of the information that's in the fact sheet, and John will talk more about the parties and some of the political implications, and then we'll come back and share a few thoughts before we do a Q&A, and I hope this will be a fairly brief introduction in every way. December 15th is really the culmination of an ambitious year of elections with a packed calendar and one that's going to continue into the new year with the constitutional rewriting and the vote that must take place within a couple of months of that being done. On the 15th, 275 seats for the Council of Representatives will be decided. 230 will be elected directly by among the 18 governorates, and the remaining 45 by a uniquely Iraqi system that will essentially require vote totaling on another basis. There's a hope, but not a requirement, that 25% of the final council will be women. And that is, they're trying to achieve that through the candidate list, where one third of the candidate lists are required to be women. The council has many big jobs that will face it almost immediately. One responsibility will be the selection of the three-person presidency council, which will then be responsible for selecting prime minister from the party with the most seats in the council. The elections themselves, the procedure again is being overseen by the Independent Electoral Commission for Iraq, which in recent polling has received a fairly high recognition of over 60% of the public knows who they are, and 64% favorable ratings in polling that was done by by IRI, the Republican Institute. These are comprised of nonpartisan Iraqis, and so far I think have received good reviews from the prior elections. There's an expectation by many that this will be perhaps the biggest turnout of the various elections of this past year, and it will be conducted in over 6,200 polling stations around the country. So once again, a very complicated process. There are over 300 registered political groups, and with about 19 separate coalitions. I'm sure John will talk about some of this. And there's still the issue of how many candidates, around 150 or so candidates, are being reviewed for disqualification at this time. The monitoring of the election will be mostly done by Iraqis. There's going to be a modest international participation because of the concerns of public safety. The numbers are quite high, but there's expected to be maybe as many as 50% more monitors than were seen in October's constitutional referendum. And finally, on the security issue, the plans are really not have not been made public yet in many regards in terms of the role of the internationals, but there's an expectation that some of the measures that have been taken in the past will be repeated. They were seen as being fairly successful, border closures, curfews, increased checkpoints, and really a much greater street presence than is enjoyed on a daily basis. So that's some of the background for the election. I think the fact sheet also will provide you with more of that, but I hope that sets the table.
Thank you very much, Rick. It's good to see everybody this morning. if a conservative is a liberal who's been mugged, the president is rediscovering compassionate conservatism in Iraq, the administration is turning more conservative in Iraq, and Iraqis are turning more conservative too. There's a remarkable shift in expectations, especially in the United States. The administration is talking much less about Iraq as an inspiration for the region, and instead it's talking about managing Iraq and getting out. There's remarkably little discussion about this idea about Iraq being a beacon of democracy, and much more trying to convince Americans that Iraq isn't a looming disaster. I think there's a growing understanding that the elections of December 15th won't end uncertainty, but merely lead uncertainty into a new phase. There's going to be a process of bargaining to constitute the new government, and then there'll be a four-month phase of constitutional amendments, which will be the most perilous phase yet. The stakes are higher than ever, because if you lose now, if you lose in this process over the next 6 months, you lose for the next 50 years, and everybody knows that. After the election, politics in Iraq are going to go into a period of utter darkness as skilled politicians carefully assess their strengths, bluster, and cut backroom deals to improve their lot and that of their constituents. I think there's certainly a chance of success, and of course there's not a guarantee of success, but partly a lot of that depends on how you define success. Those in the U.S. government who wanted to define success, such as expanding the rights of women, will likely see women's rights restricted compared to women's rights under Saddam, and certainly in the south of Iraq. Those who wanted to define success in Iraq as Iraq being a prosperous country are likely to be disappointed, as will those who saw the new Iraq as being a socially liberal society. Those who imagined a strong and unified government will be confounded by the strength of the provinces and the relative weakness of the central government. I think Ambassador Khalilzad has done a fairly good job paving the way for Sunni participation and moving the vote along. I mean, if you think back to the previous votes in Iraq, there has always been talk about moving the dates, and a sense of should we move the dates, can we move the dates. And there hasn't been talk about moving these dates. I think that's one mark of the sense that there are genuine Iraqi politics which are taking over, and there's a process that people begin to have confidence in. I think electing parliamentarians on a provincial basis is also a significant step forward, because finally parliamentarians will have constituents. It's a remarkably important change over the way Iraq has been run since the fall of Saddam. People actually have constituents, and people actually have representatives. They say they should represent my interests. And that's a real step forward. But it seems to me, if you look at what the likely outcome of the elections will be, it's a return to primordial identifications, ethnic and religious identifications, and toward groups that will both protect people and deliver wealth to them. I think one of the most surprising things to the White House must be that almost three years after the fall of a 30-year Ba'athist dictatorship in Iraq, elections in Iraq remain almost entirely content-free and are all about resources. Three decades of oppressive ideology did not lead to a thirst for liberalism, but instead helped shape a pervasive fear that leads people to seek protection from decidedly undemocratic forces. In addition, almost 3 years of increasing Iraqi self-rule has not led to the emergence of a competent class of local administrators. Politics are horribly corrupt, and national politicians are remarkably weak delivering services. Of course, this opens up room for religious groups and religious organizations who are often extraordinarily competent at delivering services, and this helps explain some of their strength. I think the other issue is this issue of the rise of religious forces. Clerics, I think it's important to remember, are not politicians in the traditional sense, because they actually have unbending principles. They actually think there's a truth there. The other part of this is that clerics are often very good at being respectful of somebody else or commanding respect, but they're often not as good working in peer groups. And when you're talking about trying to make national Iraqi politics work, a group of people who are all looking to be shown respect or to show respect to somebody else coming together sometimes makes for a chaotic political environment. I think one of the enduring problems in Iraq is the problem of Iraqi expectations. As the Americans swooped in and destroyed the Iraqi army in less than 3 weeks, there was a sense that Iraq would soon look like Dubai. Yet, long accustomed to being passive under Saddam, Iraqis showed themselves to be equally passive after Saddam's fall. The key victory of the insurgency has been to puncture the notion of American capacity. For many Iraqis, the U.S. invasion has not led to an improvement in their daily lives. Foreign ideologies are more suspect than they've ever been in Iraq. I think it's very important to remember Iraqis aren't looking for the best possible system. Iraqis are looking for a system that is acceptable, one they can live with. And that system is unlikely to be liberal as we understand that term. It would be nice to have a sense for what the outcome of the elections will be, but we simply don't. The country is too unsafe to conduct traditional polls. I think the official Shia list seems very well positioned, and the Kurds will likely see a modest decrease in seats as proportional representation limits their gains from ethnic unity. Sunnis will have a role, and there will be strong encouragement, not least from the United States, to bring at least some Sunni parties or some Sunni forces into the ruling coalition. There are few indications that the secular forces, largely led by Alawi, will do well, but if they do, they could play an important role as sort of a kingmaker. Most likely outcome, though, is one that includes a strong Shia Kurdish core devolves power to the periphery. It's important to remember the traditional Shia, the Shia interests, the Shia parties, the traditional Shia religious leadership is strong and conservative. The Kurdish leadership is strong and relatively liberal, at least in U.S. social terms. And the way you solve that conundrum is federalism. So you devolve power, you say the Kurds can do whatever they want where the Kurds live, the Shia can do whatever they want where the Shia live, and the problem is that everybody leaves the center of the country alone. It doesn't have resources, necessarily, and you have more conflict because Baghdad is a mixed community. You have people fighting from different communities, and what you could see is a relatively prosperous north and south and continued conflict for a very long time in the much more mixed center, which is also the place where the Sunni communities live and where the Sunnis feel, as I've said before, that their country is being stolen away from under them. How many Sunni parties will sign up to what some will see as the dismemberment of their country, a strong federal system, is unclear, and there'll certainly be a lot of posturing on each side before any real deals are made. I think we're going to have the electoral returns next week, but it's probably going to be 6 months until we understand what the results of the elections will be.
Just add a couple of concerns to what John just said. I think that obviously the first concern is about the management of the elections themselves, and clearly the public safety issue is the first and largest and most unpredictable element of the whole event. We know that there will be intimidation. We know that there will be charges of vote fraud. We know that some of them will likely to be valid. But the question of open participation is really driven mostly by the threat and the fear of violence. I don't think there's any way to predict that, but I think that's clearly still the greatest concern about election day and the period around the election. The second concern that I have is that the half-life of these elections, the value of these elections, has seemed to get shorter from one election to the next. And it's mostly because there's been a question about the authenticity of the results, not the election results themselves, but the results that these new elected officials are producing. So really, the way this election will be measured in terms of whether it's a success or not will be shown by the ability of these newly elected officials to handle an extremely ambitious agenda in a very short period of time, which has been obviously the great danger of this accelerated calendar that they've been facing for the last year and a half through the whole democratization process. And the issues that they will be facing, not just the organizing of themselves, which is difficult under any circumstances, but particularly so for a group of people who've never really had to do this way before. We still have a group of relatively inexperienced politicians, and they're going to have to move right away to then elect their leaders to get themselves organized. But then they're going to have to get on to really gain their legitimacy and to really be seen by the Iraqi public as something more than an extension of the occupation forces. They're going to have to clearly address three big issues that have not that Iraqi politicians have not taken ownership of yet. And the first is obviously the foreign occupation and what to do with the foreigners in their country. If they don't take that issue up pretty quickly, I think that their credibility within the country is likely to be suspect. The second is they're going to have to come up with a security model that their country men and women have confidence in. And the third is they're going to have to come up with a wealth-sharing model that actually engages the Iraqi people rather than looks like a Baghdad solution by green zone politicians. So those are that would make a busy and ambitious agenda if it was here in Washington, let alone in a place where you're getting 275 people together really for the first time ever. And asking them to get all these things done really in the next few months. There has to be progress right away for this success, for this election to have a half-life of more than a few days. I think, John, unless you want to add something else, why don't we go to your questions and comments.
Thanks. I'm Pam Heston with UPI. I have a couple. I was hearing from people down in the South that there is, and I don't know if you guys know about this, but there's a coalition now between Yamas and Tata Sadr and Skiri. And is that throughout the country? And do you have any sense of how that coalition is expected to do? And also yesterday, the Iraqi National Congress sent out a raft of documents accusing and supposedly approving corruption that was going on during Alawi. And I suspect it has something to do with this election, but I don't know if you guys saw that.
Do you want to do the
Skiri
part?
Yep. My understanding is that Muqtada's people were brought onto this unified Shia list some time ago. Muqtada Sadr's forces are sort of the X factor in Iraqi politics, because everybody thinks they're very strong, but they don't have a lot of standing forces. So they're perceived to have moral authority. They're perceived to have a good organization, and in some ways that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. I think Muqtada has also proven himself to be one of the great politicians in post-war Iraq. If you haven't read Anthony Shadid's Nitro Is Near Yet, he has a fascinating account of sort of the growth of Muqtada, which I think has only continued, and the people I know who've been back and forth to Iraq continue to be impressed at the consensus that Muqtada is really the fastest rising force in that country. Bringing him on is dangerous because you assume that he's going to stay at 30% of the coalition, and containing his ambitions could be a headache after the elections, but certainly before the elections, I think it's one of the things that the Shia list sees as part of their strength. I'm shocked that Ahmed Chalabi would be near people who tolerated corruption.
But did you say?
INC put out a whole bunch of documents, some in Arabic, some in English, supposedly approving corruption on different things, including
stuff for
helicopters, and
yeah. I think the corruption stories will be a daily there'll be a daily supply of corruption stories, I would guess, for the next few years across the board.
Yeah, I'm Johnny off the Michigan Interest Papers. From Rumsfeld through Casey on down, these elections are setting the stage for a discussion about troop levels. The Secretary said it's going to come on down to 1,000 probably fairly soon. what sorts of time frames are events going to unfold in Iraq that will allow, you know, a really legitimate conversation about U.S. troop levels to occur? It's going to be, we're talking about 3 or 4 months after the Constitution has been amended, 6 months, as you said, when the elections start to really show themselves. What sorts of time frames are you talking about?
I think on the U.S. policy side, I mean, this may be a little too inside baseball, but my sense is there are a bunch of people in the U.S. government who've said, I'm going to stick it through the Iraqi elections and I'm throwing in the towel on this job. And I think you're going to see a change in personnel on the USG side, partly with diplomats coming home, partly with others moving around. I mean, Iraq is more than a full-time job. And I think there are a lot of people who said, I will stick it through until these elections. So I think what happens initially is the Iraqis then sort of go into huddle. And the immediate U.S. side is going to be some people say, I'm coming home now, or I'm shifting portfolios or something. My guess is, in general, the whole discussion of troop levels is driven by congressional politics and the election next November, and that's going to shape it as much, if not more, than what's actually happening on the ground in Iraq.
I have a slightly different view. I think this whole discussion of troop levels has been almost been completely initiated from this end, from the United States, and finally the meeting of the political parties, of the Iraqi political parties, took it up as something that they should be getting in front of as well. An issue that 80% of their people have a very distinct feeling about, at least from the polling, however reliable or unreliable it is, suggests. So to me, the whole discussion of what's needed on the ground and how it should take place has to be driven by the Iraqi politicians. If they don't drive it, there's virtually no, they lose all their credibility. They continue to be essentially puppet-like figures in this process. And this is one of the three central issues that it's most in the minds of Iraqis. So I think that they need to push this agenda. I mean, it would have been good if it had been pushed a month ago or 2 months ago or 3 months ago by the supposed Iraqi leadership. But until that happens, you really aren't going to have an understanding of it in Iraq or here in this country. And that will change the debate in this country dramatically. If they call for negotiations, immediate negotiations for a phased withdrawal, that would change the tenor of the whole debate and give them some credibility. And then it gives them the standing also to take on the other foreigners who are there, the terrorists who are in the country as well.
Elise?
Hi, Elise, CNN. Do you think that there's a genuine desire on this administration's part for the Iraqis to kind of start calling the shots and running the show? Or do you think that once Iraqis start to do that, the U.S. is going to say, you know, we'll do it in our time when we're ready? I mean, I know there's a desire to start pulling out troops, but, I mean, the administration keeps talking about, like, this is an Iraqi process, this is an Iraqi process. But even when you have negotiations with politicians
calling shots. I don't think that it has been sincere. I think we've been trying to control the game. These are chaotic circumstances. Control is the last thing that you get out of them. You're lucky if you can play the role of a shepherd. And we've been trying to build a very tight corral, and it hasn't worked, obviously. So this is the ultimate issue of trust. And on the other hand, it would probably be the best way for us to resolve this issue, which our political process isn't going to resolve in the coming months. And so it would be a huge favor to us if they were to call for this. But every time an Iraqi politician suggests that he's going to do it, there does seem to be an invisible hand that delays or pulls him off stage. So.
Ayatollah was really kind of seen as the U.S. favorite in terms of the election. We saw a belief then that his popularity isn't exactly strong, especially in religious Shia areas. Are we likely to see an Iraqi government that is not quite favorable to the United States and could, in fact, not be an enemy, but definitely not be the close ally that the U.S. is hoping to install.
Go ahead, John.
I don't sense a lot of gratitude to the United States in Iraq, and therefore politicians aren't going to get ahead by talking about their good friends, the Americans. The sense that Iraqis have is that the Americans failed to deliver, and that American failure to deliver is not because of incompetence, but because of ill will. That perception is not easily changed. And I think as we go more toward populist Iraqi politics, which is partly in the American interest, those politics will lead Iraq's leaders not to seem like an extension of the U.S. government. The problem is they have a security capacity problem absent U.S. forces, and they're going to have to find their way doing that. My guess is that part of the way you do it is by having a somewhat ambiguous policy with some people who say one thing and some who say another.
I think there are still some people in the U.S. government who hope that we can shape the nature of this next government. I think there are still some people who are in the overly meddlesome side of the equation. And they're not going to give up their habit of trying to shape events at every step of the process, whether they'll get their way or not. I think that's a bit unpredictable right now. But this is such a late-breaking event. The tight calendar, the late list of candidates, the breaking coalitions, there's just so many elements that for people who love short elections, we're really getting a good taste of them.
Guy. What are your views on how a federal system, which is going to be, everyone predicts, a very weak central government and stronger regions, is that going to be capable of producing a strong national army that can deal with the insurgency? Or do you think that the sort of fragmentation of Iraq will also lead to a strengthening of the local militias in the south, militias and Ba'ath Brigade and Peshmerga and everything? And if that happens, then how do the U.S. withdraw without leaving chaotic fragmentation behind?
Yeah, I don't know if Rick agrees. My sense is that you'll have stronger military and law enforcement in the north and south, and a much more difficult situation in the center. The core issue is, as I said, it's going to be resource allocation. And people are going to have to make the trade-off. How much security do you think you can get by giving how much to violent groups or groups that are sympathetic to violent groups? The police in the South, as you know, have made a strong effort to incorporate the militias, as have the Peshmerga, partly because you want guys with weapons training to feel some loyalty. The outcome is not going to be one outcome. We're going to continue to see a huge diversity in the security situation in the country.
Almost completely agree with what John said. I think that the safest places in the country right now are somewhat privatized still. And so there is a de facto, that is the reality on the ground. And that's not going to change overnight. I think what could change and what the elections could produce is if people in the country, including these newly recruited soldiers and police, feel that it is worth that the new government is worth fighting for, that it is in fact an authentic Iraqi voice, then the effectiveness of those people becomes much, much greater than it is right now. Right now, they're not only amateurs; the real professionals are the privatized militias and the insurgent, the leftover Republican guards. Those are the most skilled Iraqi fighters in the country right now. So we've got amateurs working against professionals, but the amateurs have a chance if they have some spirit. And up until now, it'd be hard to say that they're inspired by the Green Zone leadership that they've been offered. And so the likelihood that they're going to be victimized is even greater. That's the great opportunity here, especially if this new government takes on the issue of the foreigners and what to do. We've advanced an artificial calendar, and we've wanted people to believe in things that really are truly important, such as constitutions and elections. But we've done it at a time when the public had other things that were more on their minds. And so consequently, in a way, we've diminished the value of these exercises because we haven't been addressing what's most on people's minds: public safety, wealth sharing, what the heck are these foreigners doing, and what are their long-term plans. None of those things are that hard to address, but we just haven't been comfortable with what the answers might be.
That's fine. Two questions. Rick, you use the word Iraqi people, and you use the 80% want us out. Is it 100% of the 80% that are not Kurds? In other words, how do you define Iraqi people? The Kurds 100% want us there, and the 100% of the other people don't, changes the quote dimensional. And then the second point would be the question. Absent federalism, which obviously the Sunnis are not happy with, they're not going to be happy with anything. Is there an end game, or what's the purpose of the whole thing if there is no end game for the Sunnis?
I can't tell you that. I haven't broken down the polling, so I don't know whether it's 100% of the rest of the people. But I would guess when we did one of our measure of progress studies of the whole country, we did interviews all over the country. We were surprised that in the Kurdish area, how much dissatisfaction there was with their existing government. That was one of the surprises we had. So they weren't particularly happy with what they were getting for. No, I recognize, but so I think even the notion of sort of I think there's pluralism within all these groups, and that's one of the things that we constantly miss. So I would be disinclined to believe that it was 100% of the Kurds are in favor of the U.S. and 100% of the other people want the occupation removed.
Let's break down a fallacy, which is the idea that the Sunnis are united. They're not. The Shia aren't united. They're more united than the Sunnis are. The Sunnis aren't united at all. There are going to be some Sunni groups inside, I'm sure. There's a lot of pressure from some of the neighboring states on the Sunnis to play ball a little bit. And we've heard about the Iraqi Islamic Party and others getting some inducements to support the referendum. So you're going to have some Sunnis in. The question is that become a dynamic where Sunnis feel vested in this system or not? And a lot of that depends on how much the Sunnis try to get and how much the Shia and Kurds think they deserve. And that ultimately is a political negotiation. And as that's one of the reasons why the formation of the government is going to take so long and the constitutional amendment process is going to take so long. Because the chips are going to really be down. And this is really going to determine what the future is going to look like. And there's going to be a whole bunch of bluster and people trying to use every possible tool they have. I mean, this is real politics, not American politics, this is real politics. And it really, really matters.
We're a couple of days since the Saddam trial already. It's already taken on the question is, what do you think about the timing of the trial right now, just before the election, when Americans are trying to unite people on the political process, and maybe the long-term impact, or the longer-term impact of this trial for the political process in U.S. goals?
I haven't perceived a huge Iraqi interest in the trial. I mean, not in the sort of, it's not like the OJ trial, as far as I can tell. That's about the past, not about the future. And I think Iraqis concerned. They know what I think a lot of them know what they want to know about the past, and their concern is their future going to be any better? So my sense is Iraqis are not getting distracted or drawn into it, but I could be misreading. I haven't been to Iraq and have no near-term plans of going, so I could just be misreading the situation.
I tend to think it's I would say that it is important, and that it does, that it will capture the public imagination. And the key, the timing to me isn't as important as whether the process is perceived as being fair. It's so public that almost everybody's going to have a chance to shape an opinion. The fact that it's televised, the fact that they're seeing this guy. But my guess is it may be like Milosevic, that over time there will be his initial outbursts, his initial proclamations and whatnot, his insults will have some tabloid quality to them, but that his half-life is probably going to diminish considerably as he turns into a tyrant with tirades. It's not great. So, but I think it's important that it be seen as fair, and the timing had to be seen as fair. I think they've taken quite a long time preparing the trial for at least the domestic Iraqi consumption. I mean, most people want to see justice carried out much faster than that. So the fact that they've taken the time to prepare it, I think the whole process looks as if it has a balance to it, and that's about all you can do with these cases.
Just Saddam himself. I mean, we talk a lot about the insurgency made at this point. We have Saddam loyalists. Is Saddam himself now still an iconic figure, or has he been reduced basically to just a bearded guy in chains in terms of the Iraqi?
I mean, I think your Milosevic reference is probably the right one. I mean, I think I'm sure he has people who still think he's terrific. I remember in the last days of the Nixon administration, the polls here in the United States said that 29% of Americans still believed in Nixon, and the best letter I've ever seen in the New York Times said it just proves you can fool 29% of the people 100% of the time. So whatever body politic there is, there's always going to be a nucleus of folks that hang with you. I think as Barney Frankton said, it said your base is the people who are with you when you're wrong. So that's, I think there's that potential is always there.
Well, and you know, Saddam remains the symbol of the guy who said no, right? And in a world in which people are consumed with a sense of humiliation and unfairness, standing up and saying no to that resonates with people, at least some people.
Yeah.
Jack Carroll from the Denver Post. Tom, since we have dumped the brutal dictator to destroy the chance that this rogue state is going to form a nexus with terrorists, give them weapons of mass destruction, is there any American national interest that really would suffer by us having minimal presence there and letting Iraq descend into a free state with a very messy nation?
If you like Afghanistan, you'll love Iraq with all of its oil. I mean, I think that the idea that you'd have elements of Iraq that would be a potential national base for terrorist groups, a way people could go in and out so close to the Gulf. With so much access to money,
large-scale training camps set up in the messy middle. Could you have, you know, if the Marines are right offshore and we retain the ability to strike?
Yeah, because training camps are, you know, not resource intensive.
What's the difference between that and the border area between Afghanistan and Pakistan?
It's better located. You presumably will have more people with access to cash. It's less remote. I mean, it seems to me we don't necessarily have to go to that outcome, and I think that creates a management problem significantly greater than what we are going to have to manage, and we should avoid it.
Well, I'm just trying to figure out why it's worth 1,000 lives a year.
Yep. My suspicion is that we will end up with a negotiated phase withdrawal that will start in 2006 and probably go for a couple of years, and that we will have a residual capacity of over-the-horizon response, wherever that's placed, a training capacity, and some embedded capacity. I think that those elements will probably stay to address the kinds of issues that John has said will be ongoing concerns. We won't have real comfort about, and probably the Iraqi government will not have real comfort about. And in a way, we will also have Iraq underneath our protective shield, our larger protective shield, so in the way that Kuwait is. If somebody were to attack Kuwait right now, they are under an invisible shield, basically. And Iraq would have that same advantage. Now, the issue of base is the issue of losing 1,000 Americans a year and whatnot. I think this model would have to be a much more agile model, has to be much more of a surprise model. For the time I spent in Afghanistan, the difference for me being on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan, in Iraq you felt as if the nasty surprises might come your way. In Afghanistan, it feels as if we may be the ones who are able to provide the nasty surprises. So if you don't know, and that creates a very dramatic difference on the ground. And so I suspect we will end up moving in that direction.
That's exactly right.
I still don't understand what's in it for me and my 20-year-old son.
Well, I think what's in it, I think the only things, our ongoing engagement there go back to the issues that John raised, which are basically, it's a big place. It's in an important neighborhood. There is the opportunity for these people to be well funded. So there is a terrorist dimension to it, an ongoing terrorist dimension to it, and there's obviously an oil dimension to it. I think those are probably our two ongoing. Plus, we have an interest in the region in advancing a different form of governance, because we think that the regional form of governance is inherently unstable, even though it may be stable for a day or the next 5 years. But it's inherently has weaknesses. I think those are our larger interests.
But I think the other part is your premise is it would take 1,000 lives a year, and I think what Rick said, and I totally agree, that you're not going to look at 1,000 lives a year indefinitely. We're going to look at a negotiated redeployment, a lot of embedded cooperation, and a lot of over-the-horizon capacity, both in military intelligence, a whole bunch of other things. And that's just not 1,000-person-a-year responsibility. There are an awful lot of people who share our interest in not having Iraq turn into a jihadi base, including all the countries around Iraq. And I think that you're going to have a general movement toward cooperating to not have that be the environment, and you're going to not have 160,000 American troops trying to provide it.
Let me throw one more thing into it. Our colleague Dan Benjamin had a good piece that many of you probably saw. I think it was in the L.A. Times a week or two ago. And he's not worried about the insurgents taking over the whole country, which I think is part of the hyping of the present circumstance. But I think the way John's described it, which is that there will be opportunities to operate out of the country, I think is a much more real concern.
I wondered, what do we know enough about the candidates so that day or week after the election, judgments can be drawn on how the Iraqi people feel about American troops being there, and how whether I get the notion now, and whether they're likely to go for another Saddam Hussein or Saddam Hussein to clasp a Quran to his chest. Your description, not only of the arrangement, the diversity, the provincial flavor of it, suggests to me, no, that even though this is an important election, it's not going to tell us much. Is that true?
This is almost an entirely content-free election. As a consequence, what it will tell us about is the organizational capacity of the different ethnic and religious groups in Iraq. It won't tell us what their bargaining skill is, which is ultimately going to be the determinant of how well they do. And the policy is going to be a consequence of how well they bargain. So I think we're sort of several steps away. Once the election returns come in, we're several steps away from knowing what the election results will be.
Can I add something to that? I mean, we've had such a presence in the place that of the 275 people, we should know most of them. And we should have, so then it really will come down to whether they will be able to come up with a cohesive leadership, which we have not seen yet, and whether they'll be able to come up with an agenda that actually addresses people's concerns. So those I think are much tougher. We'll know the personalities, right, but we can't really predict their behaviors because we haven't really seen. They've been. I keep thinking of these people as green zone politicians, but it's really it's a way of thinking of them as greenhouse politicians. I mean, they have been growing up under the shelter of a protective and essentially a rather dominant sponsor. And so now you're getting to the point where they're going to actually have to be out there on their own a little more, I hope. And if they do that, then you're going to have to see whether you get this kind of maturing. And I think that's really the big challenge.
If I can address this point, your description of their interests is a description of people interested in resources, interested in their living conditions, interested in getting at some of the wealth that presumably the Iraqi oil bomb. Okay, that, and not people overly concerned or predominantly concerned about American presence, even about terrorists. Right?
No, I think
so. If that's true, we won't be able to draw any real lessons about our policies from this election.
I think they're terribly concerned about the presence of foreigners in the country.
Yeah. The election seemed, as it was described, it was an election about people, you know, like in Portugal or in Kenya.
No,
voting about their lives, voting about a better life.
But I think if you take John's argument that it's been sort of a content-free process. I think part of that is just the rush of the calendar, is the pressure of the calendar to get these, just to execute the elections. I happen to think that the average Iraqi has been extremely concerned with their personal safety for some time, and the inability of the foreigners, who are really there supposedly to deliver that, to not make the country safe. So I think that issue has been by far the most important in the minds of the Iraqis, but we've been giving them sort of a diet of elections and constitution writing and other things, which normally would be the most important thing in people's minds, but I think they've been of secondary interest.
Even if we did a bad job of keeping them safe, at least we were trying.
Well, because I think ultimately, I mean, most people who are experts on insurgency, and I am not, suggest that you have to have the political dimension in the right place. And right now, the political dimension is not in the right spot. The political dimension is, if you have a problem in the country with your constitution, with your public safety, with your oil production, it's pretty much the Americans' responsibility or fault. That doesn't put the responsibility where it needs to be. And until you get that right, you don't really make progress on anything else, in my view.
And if I could just walk back, I mean, are people concerned about the American presence? Yes. Do they see the elections as a way to advance their interest there? No. They see the elections as a way to demonstrate their loyalty to the people who will take care of them. They'll continue to have all sorts of discussions. They'll continue to try to lobby and everything else. But the elections are a time to wave the flag and lock in the support of the people who you hope are going to protect you. And not much more than that.
I think John and I might have a slight variation on that because... Yeah. That's fine. See, I do agree with John that elections have that purpose. But if the elections are going to mean anything, they're going to have to take on these issues. They should have taken on before the election the existing interim government could have done it. But since they haven't, that's really going to be the business of this new government. If they take it on, I think then you can get beyond sort of these highly individualized, highly regionalized, highly personalized, all the other divisions that you have, and you might start to have an Iraqi view. If you don't have an Iraqi view, then I think the whole enterprise is pretty shaky.
But the question is also that once you have these elections and you have an elected class of leaders, how are they going to hold on to power afterwards? I mean, some people are talking about, like, this is a division and everybody's waiting for the playoffs when the American leave. One of the phenomena that people have noticed, for instance, is like the army, which is a traditional base of support for leaders there, has been basically fragmented, where most of the battalions are not ethnically mixed, they're ethnically separated. So how is anybody who's elected in this going to be able to count on any institutional support after the Americans leave?
They're going to do it with money. Mm-hmm. It's about dividing the resources. Quite frankly, because this is all resource driven. I mean, not to belabor this point, but I'm going to belabor it a little more. The reason that elections work, the reason why elections are uncertain in this country, is because people have multiple identities, right? You may be upper class, white, male, professional, living in a certain region, certain religious values, I mean, all sorts of things, liberal, conservative, and you sort of trade off between these different identities. And the reason why you sometimes vote for Republican candidates and sometimes vote for Democratic candidates, at least for some people, is because they're trading off between their identities. The whole idea of soccer moms and NASCAR dads, all these constructions are people who have multiple identities. In Iraqi politics, people don't have multiple identities, right? People say, I am voting with my folks, and my folks are a relatively fixed, singular identification. And as long as that's the case, we don't have people trading off and imagining themselves in different kinds of ways and belonging to several groups. People belong to one group, and the way they advance their interests is by advancing the interests of their group. That's totally what's going on.
Elected are going to do. They're not going to, like, you're not going to have these politicians that are elected to national office and they're going to say, I'm going to make the country better for all of the populations. They're going to do what they want.
Dance with the one that brung you.
Yeah, I mean, I think by and large, where I would agree with John on this is by and large, politicians do work off of their base first. And John is describing a series of fairly narrow bases that politicians are anchored with. I think the only thing that will make this election really significant is if you can get some unity of purpose. And there are issues that, in fact, probably unite most Iraqis and that you could develop to unite Iraqis. A national wealth sharing plan that has a national share, a governance share, and then a share for individual Iraqis would probably be an idea that could capture the imagination of almost all Iraqis. And that's a way to get around sort of this, everybody has their own and they feed their own first model. So there are opportunities here, but they really got to take them on. This issue of the national occupation and the presence of foreigners, first and foremost, probably the United States, but not too far behind them, foreign terrorists, is really an issue of national unity. If somebody takes it on, you have a chance to have a lot of politicians on the same side because they do have a common interest. But I'm not disagreeing with John's analysis. I think there's probably a likely course of events, and then there is a narrow opening for a more successful course of events. And so my argument is, it'd be nice to have somebody articulate that, and it'd be nice to have the United States, for example, trying to promote that rather than getting stuck in this sort of identity politics, that single identity politics that John's describing.
Gian Piero Granaglia with the Italian News Agency ANSA. Does the presence of international troops in Iraq have today or after the election any meaning for Iraqis, or there is just a meaning for Americans not to be alone there? And second question, a follow-up to my Colorado colleague. If the problem is don't have a terrorist base or terrorist bases in Iraq, wasn't safer, surer, more under control the situation before than now?
Well, if you're going to align yourself with that troublemaker from Denver, I think first and foremost, the presence of foreign troops has huge meaning to the Iraqis, and that's why it's so vital that their government leaders there take this issue on themselves rather than being delivered the results of our deliberation here. I personally think it would be one of the most dramatic messages to be heard in John's part of the world, really, is if the Iraqi government called for the start of negotiations to set a phased withdrawal. I just think that would be seen as a radical departure. I mean, somebody that the Iraqis are actually in the lead in their own country. I mean, that's been our rhetoric, but it hasn't been our reality. And so nothing like aligning reality with rhetoric to get greater mileage for your ideas. So I just believe that's got to be the case. You want to take the second part of that? Or?
To some degree, you've addressed this question, but do you see any strong possibility of a collapse of an Iraqi army or their police forces, that the insurgents will just keep on hitting away and so forth, and sooner or later, they just the army in effect would run them?
Yeah. I think it's possible, but you have to realize that the safest places in the country right now are not really being run by the Iraqi army or by the United States military. The safest parts of the country are being run by local militias. So there's been all this discussion about the ink spot or whatever, that theory. Well, if you did an ink spot of Iraq right now, most of the existing ink spots would have sort of variations of Peshmerga and other militias, even when so that's kind of the reality. I doubt that all of these systems. I've tried to sort of think of this. What's the existing security system in the country? You have 150,000 U.S. You have 10,000 other internationals. You have 20,000 or so private security that pretty much are on our side, mostly former Western soldiers, and then you have somewhere between 40 and 100,000 capable, depending on who you're listening to, capable Iraqis. And then on top of that, you probably have 50 to 100,000 that are not militias that are not showing up in any official census. So the number on the ground is already rather different than the one that most of us are discussing, because most of us talk about this thing in terms of 150,000 Americans, maybe 10,000 other coalition members, and then we sort of talk about the capable Iraqis, but there are a lot of other capable Iraqis who are already on our side. So the equation is really quite a bit richer, but that opportunity to disrupt, I think the only way you really break the insurgency is if you get those people who are genuine nationalists to oppose the presence of the foreign insurgents, and that's your only chance to really break this thing. That's the political dimension, and that's why I keep coming back to this. And the one argument that the Sunnis have made from the beginning, and I don't think it's necessarily sincere, but it's been made, is we won't really fully participate until the issue of foreign occupation is addressed. So I always like to call people on the question that they put on the table, and then now we know where you are. And again, a phased withdrawal offers you an awful lot of opportunities. The way we're deployed could change. I mean, again, when you drive around Iraq, we have this garrison, this feeling of garrisons of really being, and then we go out on patrols at 60 miles an hour. You know, it's just, you don't have the feeling that we're in the communities very well.
Barry, did you?
Well, I think I know the answer, but.
Can sit next to us.
No, I mean, I think I know what you would say because you sort of said it already. But I have trouble in not thinking this is an election of the sort that's a referendum on Saddam Hussein's rule. Either that things are awfully chaotic and he was a bad guy, when I'm thinking of the Soviet, you know, post-Soviet Union period, I mean, all those Alzheimer's with their red flags and red square, I mean, they sort of were sentimental about Soviet rule. Things were orderly. You describe this election as they've moved on. That is way in the past to them. That Saddam Hussein is maybe something they read about, their grandparents told them about. You know, I mean, Saddam Hussein was in their lives. So I would think they're either trying to reconstruct a society where it's Iraqi, it's nationalistic, and the Americans would get the hell out, or they want to do everything they can to prevent a recurrence.
But who would,
a clerical recurrence, perhaps, or something.
But what would represent a vote for Saddam in that referendum?
What you say there's no liberal, you don't see a liberal outcome to begin with, liberal in the sociopolitical sense.
Right.
Right? So, I mean, already it sounds like you're saying they're inclined to take a cautious conservative view.
Right, with Kurdistan being relatively socially liberal by Iraqi standards, but
have their own, follow their own lights, which is why they still survive.
I don't see a party that would represent the sort of back to the good old days under Saddam. What I see is an array of parties and groupings of people who say, I can protect you and I can drive resources to you.
I don't see an idealization of Saddam in many places. There, people probably liked the order, but they didn't like the way the order was achieved. So I don't see that there's a kind of a nostalgic dimension to this election, but maybe we just haven't picked that up yet.
Except to the extent that people say we're not going to go like lambs to the slaughter, right? I mean, and you see that in the Sunni areas, right. The sense that what Saddam represents is resistance to being completely screwed, and will support that. And I think you're seeing that among different Sunni groupings. What you thought was true, what you thought we'd say.
No, you did it better than.
We're going to take just a couple more.
Yeah.
Whoops.
Yes, Tsutomu Ishii, Asahi Shimbun, Japanese newspaper. Actually, the State Department just started deploying some PRTs in Iraq, which I understood the slight difference from the ones in Afghanistan. How much do you think will it have the impact to the political process after the election, and also the kind of follow up, what kind of options for the United States to strengthen the political process after the elections?
I can probably answer that. I've visited some of the PRTs in Afghanistan. I haven't really heard what the design is going to be for these PRTs in terms of how different they'll be from.
I understood it's a military led in Afghanistan, but in Iraq, it's a State Department to take charge.
But they'll still be the same balance of 50 soldiers plus 1 to 5 civilians, and the advantage the provincial reconstruction teams. The advantage they have is that they do hasten the liquidity into places that should be too dangerous for civilians to work, which is a lot of the problem areas. I'm not sure yet whether they'll have much of an impact, because we've already put quite a lot of money into commander funds in some of these troubled areas, so I'm not sure how different this will be other than there may be the presence of the civilians in that mix might be richer, which I think would be advantageous, because the military, you really have to have multiple skills, and we don't have most of the people we have on the ground are not Clark Kent or even his other identity, and you basically have to do a very sophisticated political analysis. You have to be able to build community relations. You have to find local ownership, and then you have to bring money to it, those are not all pieces that our military historically has been trained to do. So the idea of the PRT is that you're going to get that enrichment from bringing other branches of the civilians into the process. I think that's necessary, but I have a feeling a lot of these ideas in Iraq are basically a day late and a dollar long, because we missed the moment. We are now spending twice as much money to do it, and I'm not convinced that it's going to take hold. Not that they're bad ideas, but a good idea in the wrong time ends up not being as good an idea.
Can I just follow up on that? Because the president kind of talked about this yesterday, and I knew I was going to see you, so I know it's not necessarily directly related to the elections, but it does kind of, as you said, it is one of the areas that the new government will have to pick up. I mean, what do you see as the kind of reconstruction picture, though? The president cited all of this success, but it kind of seem to be in these two remote areas, and these two, you know, he cited a few statistics, but I'm sure you have a fuller picture of what's been done in the country. I mean, when we talk to Iraqis that come over or whatever, they say it's, you know, disaster.
I'm a little bit uncomfortable with being able to second-guess the president too much, because I'm afraid that I don't and he doesn't really have very good information. I mean, there's one overriding problem here, and that is it's too dangerous for most of our friends to go anywhere. So consequently, reporting on how well things are going or questioning whether they're going well is on either side of the equation, you're really kind of flying blind. And that's really what worried me about. There was a lot about the president's language yesterday was more modest, more realistic than any prior speech, and really had the right tenor for my thinking of the way we should have talked about this thing 2.5 years ago. So this gets to the timing issue. Again, the speech is a great speech, but maybe not so good yesterday. And I don't think... most of the people I know that are working in Iraq are working in much smaller areas than they were before and under much more limited conditions. So it's really hard to imagine. And we haven't changed the model enough. Again, if you believe, as I do, that there's always a chance to do something better, then I think you could do things in Iraq. But I didn't hear the president really talk about any of those much more entrepreneurial approaches, which would require putting direct assets in the hands of more Iraqis, working much more at the government level. He did talk about working smaller rather than larger projects. That's part of it. But you really, at this point, you've got to go on you have to start buying back the confidence of the individual Iraqi citizen, because we've lost our opportunities to really create many of these sort of governing coalitions that you have to have in these early stages if you want to get efficiencies. So, I talked to one reporter last night and who had been at the hospital in Najaf and said, "Oh, that's known as they didn't say it a disaster zone, but it was basically the first floor had been remodeled, the rest of it had been looted, you know, and there was just and this was one of the examples." And you go, "Well, obviously the president doesn't really know how that." Hospital in Najaf is operating, or if he does, I mean, it's a phenomenal level of detail. But so anyway, I'm still really worried. I think it's wishful, and also an economic discussion that doesn't talk about the oil and wealth sharing in the country. I mean, that's the economy. You can talk about all the everything else that you want to, but essentially, oil is the economy. Well, he may have, but I thought they were. He may have. I think they're good. I don't think they're isolated places. I think if good things were happening in either of those places, that would be great. Oh, sure. I'd be very happy in Najaf to have good news in Najaf and Mosul, personally. Yeah, I mean, those are not easy spots, and they're among the larger cities. And so. But you know, Baghdad. At the end of the day, we can talk all we want to about all the whole country. If we can't actually make Baghdad safe, I think it's pretty hard to make an argument for the country. It's basically, you know, one third of the population or so. It's the crossroads of everything. It's, as John said, it's a place where you have a rich mix of all the cultures. And we've been there a long time, and our greatest presence has been there, and Baghdad is still not really functioning. Remember, we appointed mayors of Baghdad, and we've been through a lot of different phases, and Baghdad is, for me, it's the game still.
But from what John is saying, it doesn't look like this new government that's going to come in is going to take Baghdad and say, I, you know, this is, you know, symbolic. I have to clean this up before the whole country.
But that's see, I think the president should be asking our president should be asking his team, how do we make Baghdad safe? I mean, that could be our responsibility, and that would be quite a gift to deliver to the Iraqi people. I think what John is saying is the only way you're ever going to reconstruct Iraq is if the governance take hold, because it's going to be the thought that we can create a competent central government in a few months that's going to be delivering services to all of the country particularly under these circumstances is a myth. If you were to walk into the vice president's office in this country today and say, I've got an idea for Katrina. And all those victims, I'm going to build a functioning bureaucracy of 50 or 100,000 people in Washington, D.C., and within 3 months, New Orleans will be fine. You know, you'd be on 17th Street in about, 30 seconds in your ear, right? And yet that's what we're saying, and I think Washington's an easier place to work than Baghdad. And you couldn't possibly pull that off here. So it's just, again, it's just how do we do these things in realistic ways as opposed to sort of somebody's got a vision in their head, which is just totally impractical. I saw that in Kosovo. The Europeans thought that we'd have 500 bureaucrats functioning in Pristina by October, and this was August. And they couldn't do that in Brussels by October. So why would they get it? How could they possibly deliver it in Kosovo?
Let me just think General Casey Backett, the longer we're there, the longer we'll be there. General Casey? The longer that we say that we're going to do it, the longer it's going to take before we finally say, all right, you guys do it.
I happen to agree that we've got to have this dynamic. It's got to change. I think the existing dynamic, more of the same, doing it better. Tomorrow we'll get it right. I don't happen to believe that's a winning argument.
Do you think that the idea that shock treatment, that a big withdrawal quickly, is even being scrutinized as an
administration? I don't think so.
No, I've heard no sign of it, and I think the president probably has the greatest ownership of the existing position.
This will be the last question, and thanks for coming today.
On the economy, do you have any sense of how the oil is going? And I noticed the Senate Foreign Relations Committee report that was put out yesterday talked about internally raising the price of gas from the subsidized 5 cents to 13 cents to $1.82 in 2006 when people are making it to $150 a month.
Transition's tough. The oil is not coming out nearly the levels people had hoped for, I think in many cases had planned for. It's not going to come out for some time. It's a very uncertain environment. The majors are very concerned about investing much right now. And to the extent, as Rick very rightly said, that's where the national wealth basically comes from. And as long as the insurgency is clipping along as it is, it's going to be a problem turning it around. I think one of the problems is if politics are basically about distributing oil wealth, but you can't get oil wealth until you make the politics work, you have a bit of a chicken and egg problem, which, quite frankly, the Iraqis will be muddling through for some time to come. I think you're not going to see a huge amount of Iraqi oil hit the market. You're not going to see a huge investment in Iraqi infrastructure. You're going to continue to see attacks on the infrastructure. But the oil money is what everybody's counting on is being the magic pill to make stuff work. And that's, a central problem.
Infrastructure so dilapidated that they are talking about a 12-year period just to get it working, and that's if it's not blown up on a regular basis.
We've known from the beginning that it was going to take, almost everybody said, to get this level of production it's going to take $10 billion. To get to that level of production it's going to take $20 billion. The money's being invested. The politics are not right, as John described. The oil price has been hyperinflated, so they haven't been punished too much by most of the time we've been well below the production levels during Saddam's reign. The predictions that Paul Wolfowitz had a prediction that by 2010 we'd be up to 6 million barrels a day. We're working to get to 2 million. Vice President Cheney had a prediction by the end of 2004 we'd be at 3 to 3.5 million barrels a day. So nobody's done this very well, but I personally don't think we'll ever protect that the resource will ever be protected unless the Iraqi people feel that every attack on the oil is an attack on them. And right now, it's a screw up by the United States that we're not. And so until you get that, again, it gets back to the same issue. Yeah, if you don't get the ownership right, you can't expect people to grow up. I mean, it's just, and we have kept talking that, but our actions have not been consistent with that. So. Well, I'm sorry.
$1.82 Yeah.
I haven't heard that, but you know, we got this. You got a couple of subsidy, that subsidy issue, and the food basket subsidy issue, those are opportunities as well as ways to bring down governments. And the food basket, for example, is probably, I mean, it's somewhere between $10 and $15 billion a year for the central government to buy the food basket and is still delivering it. And yeah, well, again, I mean, these are big issues, and I believe that if you gave the Iraqi people a choice of giving them cash, less cash, let's say the food basket's $800 a person, and you offered them $600 a person for food, an annual food budget, my suspicion is that they would probably take that deal, because the food baskets were never really that popular. But people are reluctant to move out of those things, but then you've got to move to a different trust system. And we've been reluctant to do that, and so I mean, I just think that you've got to change radically the way we're doing business, and we've got to move out of our central government heavy footprint, heavy-handed controlling model if we think we're going to make progress here, and that will give us a better chance against the insurgency. So in a way, it's an anti-insurgency campaign at the same time.
Just in closing, let me tell you my favorite subsidy story. In Egypt, they raised bread prices and they had riots, but they had a problem. They had to do something about the bread subsidy, which was costing the government too much money. So what they did was they introduced, this is under Sadat, they introduced a better quality of bread, which was more expensive. And then they started lowering the quality of the subsidized bread. And then they started putting foreign objects like stones and machine parts in the subsidized bread. And after a while, nobody bought it. And that's the way they did the transition toward decreasing the subsidy. But the fact that they had to go through these antics, I think, shows you the political difficulty of raising prices. And when you're talking about both the huge food subsidy, which people desperately need, as you know, plus a gas subsidy, which people feel they desperately need, as you know.
And already line up 3D.
And all politics are about resource allocation, and there's a sense, we should be rich like Dubai. How come we're not? Somebody must be stealing all the money. It must be the Americans or somebody else. You have a real political problem, which transcends the resource problem. It's a political problem.
Thank you all for coming today.
Thank you.
Thank you.